while people remain free and stand for freedom the way that we do, we will refuse to be destroyed. So let me say on behalf of the councillors and our guests that we are grateful that you have accepted our invitation, and we would very much like to hear what you might have to say with regards to our monetary system. And, thank you, sir. Thank you.
Gentlemen, if you don't mind, I can talk better if I sit down, so I won't stand up. I'm going to talk a little about the problem of mine financing, which is very, very acute in the United States. There is a shortage of liquidity. There's a shortage of cash in the United States, and paradoxically, it has come at a time when we are all drowning in a sea of paper. So we have that paradox. We also have this problem that you have hinted at that occurred in the past 48 hours, the removal of the tax holiday on the gold mining industry in Australia. Well, this is going to be a phased removal, as I understand it, as I've read it. Even if the local gold mining would make a profit, it would not, for this year, they will only have to pay taxes on 10% of their income. It would be phased out completely by 1980. Well, I'm pretty sure that something of world importance is going to occur before 1980 that will change for the better the conditions of gold mining, not only in Australia, but in the United States, all over the world. Because what we will see will be a rebirth, a redrafting of the gold exchange standard, which is not to be confused with the traditional 19th century gold standard, in which every currency was totally convertible into gold on demand. Throughout the 19th century, which was a century of the where you saw the greatest prosperity, it was a peaceful century by and large, except for the Civil War in the United States and the Crimean War. The standard of living of the people increased enormously. To no small measure, that was due to the gold standard. In effect, the fully convertible gold standard limits the spending of governments. In other words, under the gold standard, a government has to live only within the income that it can generate through taxation. Since no government is willing to live within the income it can raise through taxation, by perverting the monetary system, they were able to go into paper substitutes, not directly, but through the introduction of the gold exchange standard, where the major support currencies up until 1922 were the US dollar and the British pound, were directly convertible into gold, and then every other currency was directly convertible either into the British pound or in the US dollar. That system failed in 1922 after World War I for the very simple reason that both the United States dollar and the British pound became inflated. That kind of a gold exchange standard can survive provided that the support currencies are not inflated. That gives an enormous amount of power to the country that holds the support currency in international trade. Because if I have a monopoly over the issuance of this type of thing, which is really domestically a claim, it's no longer a medium of exchange as such, but it becomes a claim by the government against the goods and services of its own citizens, If this becomes a support currency for the whole world, it also becomes a claim against the goods and services of the citizens of another country. In other words, a worldwide rip-off. So as long as the support currency is not inflated, the gold exchange standard can survive. Well, it fell to pot in 1922. It failed again in 1931. It failed again in 1971, on August 15, 1971. And that was because, thanks to the policies of the Johnson administration, which insisted on expanding and enlarging the war in Vietnam and at the same time refusing to curtail the big, huge, megalomaniacal spending programs at home, billions upon billions of dollars, of US dollars, found their way in Europe, and all of the European central bankers who had this deluge of quickly depreciating dollars became very upset, and they started pestering the US Treasury for either a halt in the inflation or else in the full convertibility of those American IOUs into American gold. When the drain of gold from Fort Knox became alarming in its proportions, then President Nixon had no alternative but to close the gold window. Since the dollar was now no longer anchored to gold, and since all other currencies were inflating, meaning they were losing value at different rates, there was really no alternative but to go into a system of floating exchange rates, which meant that many banks had to engage more and more into foreign exchange operations. And a lot of them went bankrupt. Erstadt in Germany went bankrupt. Union Bank in California went bankrupt. Franklin Bank in New York went bankrupt. Many other banks in England, in Germany, in the United States have lost an awful lot of money. Also, multinational companies hate the system of floating exchange rates because if the exchange rate is adverse to your own country and to the country with which you are trading, those exchange rates, those floating exchange rates, can wipe out whatever profit you have made from your deal overnight. So really, nobody likes those floating exchange rates, including governments. Now, there is a push, and this is the undercurrent, it never appears in the newspapers, to reestablish the Bretton Woods system, to reestablish the gold exchange standard, which failed in 1971. The condition that has to be met is that all central banks must have as much gold into their vaults as possible. In other words, when in 1944, as the result of the Bretton Woods Conference, the member nations, the signatories to that conference, formed the International Monetary Fund, they put a portion of their stored gold and a portion of their paper currencies into this common pool of money in order to help a particular country smoothen the ups and downs in its balance of payment problems. In other words, this was a supranational or international lending agency. There are many such lending agencies. The World Bank is another one. Now, because of the worldwide wave of inflation that was unleashed by Keynesian economic policies, and when it comes to Keynesian economics, it isn't really economics. It's just a smorgasbord of all the mistakes in monetary policy going back to the invention of money as a medium of exchange all the way to the beginning of the 20th century, rephrased, repackaged in mathematical language And mathematics, incidentally, is not a science. It's merely the language of science. And just as you can lie in French or in English or in German or Italian, you can also lie in mathematics. As the result of this Keynesian policies, we have seen a worldwide wave of inflation, with some currencies losing value faster than other currencies. That makes the world a very difficult place in which to trade, in which to produce. So all of the central banks now, all of the nations, the major nations, want to get whatever portion of the gold they placed in the international monetary funds back into their vaults. They don't want to do that directly for their own particular reasons, so they have arranged the so-called sale of gold, arranged by the International Monetary Fund according to a timetable. I don't know exactly what that timetable calls for. I've heard a figure of 5 years. Within 5 years, the International Monetary Fund will have sold all of its gold. Now, the agency that buys the gold sold by the IMF is the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. The Bank of International Settlements, in effect, acts as the purchasing agent for all of the central banks in Europe. Whether it acts as a purchasing agent for the U.S. Treasury, I don't know. But the fact is this. You have seen a noticeable drop in the price of gold in the past 6 months or in the past year. Now, what is the reason for that? It's very simple. If you are going to purchase any commodity, the last thing you want to do is to extol the virtue of the particular commodity that you want to buy or that you want to seize, as the case may be. Just as if you want to sell a commodity, you want to sell at the highest possible price. Why do the central banks in the United States, why do they want to seize gold again? Because in order to set up a gold exchange standard, they must again regain control over the existing gold. Because once they do that, then the dollar can be pegged again to gold at a fixed rate of exchange, at a fixed rate of convertibility, and this time gold might be pegged at a considerably higher level than the $42.22 per ounce price, which is the price at which nobody can buy gold, and nobody is crazy enough to sell gold, so it's a totally fictitious thing. It will probably be pegged at a price considerably higher, that $35 an ounce price of gold, which existed from 1935 until 1971, that if you consider the increase in the consumer price level from 1935 until 1971, and you multiply that indicator by that $35 an ounce, you will have a fairly good idea of what the new price of gold, of the official price of gold might be. It could be somewhere between $150 and $200 an ounce, but that is merely a speculation. It might be higher. So, once the new gold exchange standard is set up, and it will be set up, I am as certain of that as I am that the sun will rise tomorrow, then you are going to see a stabilization of currencies, and there will be an enormous amount of pressure on the United States not to inflate the dollar anymore. Because if the United States were to inflate the dollar again, then suspicion by other countries will rise again, and the new monetary system will fall apart at the seams. Now, this is just by way of introduction. I was going to talk about mine financing, but rather than doing that, I'd like to keep this informal. And if you have any questions, I'll be glad, I'll try to answer them.
Young, I have a question to ask. I found your talk extremely interesting. Just recently I've become a student of an American come Canadian author, Harry Brown.
Yes.
He's written, to my knowledge, three publications, one of which he made a forecast in 1971, how to profit from the coming devaluation, bearing in mind, of course, I'm geared to the American dollar. Which forecast he made, which prediction, you know, came to be. He then wrote a second publication, how to profit from a monetary crisis, and the third publication, how I became free in an unfree world.
I've read all three of them.
It would appear to me that his philosophy is very much akin to yours. My question is, what is his standing in your field? You are, you know, no doubt an eminent economist. It would appear that Harry S. Brown is someone who has learned through the experience, the University of Experience, and carries no, academic degrees to give credence to what he proposes. But it would appear to me that what he has to say is very much in line with what you said today.
Except in one area, Harry Brown thinks that you can save your skin when there is a galloping inflation. Now, if you look at the historical record, Germans, prior to 1922, could convert their Deutsche Marks into dollars. Very few Germans saved their skin, were able to save their skin. And the thing is that inflation, a runaway inflation, which invariably leads to a depression, because in inflation, what is being debauched is the currency. In other words, you have more and more claims against goods and services. So, the classical case of too many dollars chasing too few goods. What immediately happens is that all marginal producers cannot make a profit, they'll go out of business, which creates unemployment. So even though at the beginning of the inflationary spiral, you have that concomitant variation that this economist, British economist Phillips, who's famous for the Phillips curves, has given, that your budget deficit increases, meaning as your inflation increases, your unemployment goes down, that is only valid at the beginning of the inflationary spiral. As inflation matures and gets worse, then you begin to see the shortage of goods, of services, of raw materials, and finally the worst shortage of them all, which is the shortage of jobs. A depression is not an isolated segment of the so-called business cycle. It is the only consequence of inflation. And when labor unions, well, for instance, I was a member of a labor union in New York from the time I was 17 until the time I was 25. I don't think any member of the public can go against union leaders who want more money, more benefits, more vacations for their own members. This is what they are supposed to do. This is their legitimate function. The disaster occurs when labor leaders forget that their only function is to take care of the welfare of their members, and they get involved in politics. And they say, we should not mine, for instance, as they say today in Australia, we should not mine uranium. We should not trade with South Africa. We should not ship, let's say, iron ore to Japan or to the west coast of the United States in foreign vessels. They should be shipped in Australian vessels. I don't know whether that is the case, but this is just an example. And what happens is that those policies have a disastrous effect in the country, domestically. And the same thing could be applied to large industries when big businessmen insist on protective tariffs from government, when they want subsidies, when they want special favors. Well, in the case, for instance, of tariffs, industries don't pay those tariffs. That cost, the cost of protected tariffs, is ultimately borne by the ultimate consumer, by people like us. So when it comes to subsidies, to favors, there should be no subsidy for any industry, no subsidy, no special favor to any big union. There has to be division of labor. Government should do only those things that government can do, and that is to provide objective laws by means of which citizens can resolve their financial disputes, the civil courts of law, the criminal courts of law, the police to apprehend that very, very small percentage of criminals that exist in any society, and then, of course, the military to protect the country against foreign aggression. Outside of those four functions, anything else the government does is only able to do at the direct expense of one segment of the population for the unearned benefit of another segment of the population. Take, for instance, the United States. It was formed, in theory, although the philosophy was not applied consistently in practice, it was based on upholding and defending the rights of every individual to his own life, to his own property, to his own freedom, to his own pursuit of happiness. That was not applied consistently. The Negroes were enslaved. The Civil War resulted, and a century later, we are still paying for that Civil War in the United States. Now, because of the interference of politics with all aspects of pure and applied science, and after all, economics is also a science, what has happened is that the new slaves in the 20th century are the people in the middle classes. And if you see what inflation has done in this century in all of the industrialized nations, it has destroyed the middle classes over and over again. The worst inflation, of course, is the German inflation, where the Weimar Republic, in effect, cut off its nose to spite its face. They didn't want to pay those reparations to the Allies, and since those war debts were denominated in Deutsche Marks, they figured that by debauching the Deutsche Mark, by printing paper backed by nothing except by the word politicians, they could get out of trouble. Well, what happened was that it destroyed the middle class in Germany. Unemployment reached a level of 28 to 30%. This is according to a study done by a famous European economist, Costantino Bresciani Turroni, and that paved the way to the Hitler regime. So it comes down to this, that whenever government goes outside its ethical and legal sphere of activity, it can only survive by ripping off one group of people for the benefit of another group of people.
Thank you very much.
So I would like to pose the question with regard to deficit budgeting. Now, without you becoming involved in the political affairs of this country, what are your views with regards to deficit budgeting?
Deficit budgeting. You know, there is a cliche in America: the political promises of today are the taxes of tomorrow. You know, when you take a country such as the United States, which was originally founded on the rights of the individual, you see, the American founding fathers were extremely suspicious not only of the word democracy, but of the concept itself of democracy. Democracy, in its literal Greek meaning, means mob rule. You can have, in fact, our system of government in the States is based on a limited government, constitutional, representative republic. where government is limited in what it can do by the Constitution. The Constitution in the United States is a check. It is a limitation on government. It is not a limitation on people. So, it is only when the rights of the individual are protected, when an individual is free, in the words of Thomas Jefferson, to pursue his own industry and improvement, and when government refrains individuals from harming one another, that should have what Jefferson called the essence of good government. And that is based on those four functions that I gave before: the criminal courts of law, the civil courts of law, the police, and the military. About deficit spending, that phenomenon has only occurred in the 20th century. Certainly you had deficit spending in the 19th century. But in the 19th century, you had a statutory limit on spending whenever your gold supply would go below the limit set by the central bank. So in order to finance the deficit, there was no alternative but to raise taxes. In the 20th century, governments found that they could monetize government debt. The process of debt monetization works something like this. And I'll be talking only in terms of the U.S. government. And if this applies also to Australia, all I can say is if the shoe fits, wear it. Let's say the Treasury has to finance X billions of dollars of government deficit. How does it do it? Well, one way it can do it is by increasing taxes, and that is political suicide. Another way in which it can do it is by selling government bonds. These are government IOUs, which in theory will be repaid by future taxation. Now, the sale of these government bonds in the open market means that it will reduce the amount of capital available to people in industry. The situation in 1973 was very, very bad because government borrowings in the open market accounted for 63% of all borrowing in the U.S. money markets. Because these deficits have increased since 1973, last year, U.S. borrowings accounted for 80% of all borrowings in the U.S. money market. The deficit of the federal government alone for 1977 are estimated at between $45 billion, which is the conservative figure, and $60 billion, which I think will be the more realistic figure. All of that has to be borrowed to do an honest balancing of the budget. Now, where will the money come from? The savings of individuals in the United States, the aggregate figure for savings, is about $80 billion. So if the government were to balance its books by borrowing from the public, and it has to borrow $60 billion, that will only leave $20 billion available for everybody else. Now, in the case of just one industry, which is the iron and steel industry, its capital requirements, its yearly capital requirements from 1975 to 1985 are of the order of $5 billion per year. And I just mentioned one industry. So this is why we have a liquidity squeeze. Now, William Simon was the Secretary of the Treasury, and Alan Greenspan was President Ford's Chairman of Economic Advisors, are aware of that. And they've tried very, very hard to advise Ford in vetoing new spending bills, and it was particularly because of that policy of holding the line on spending that Jerry Ford has been able to reduce the inflation rate in the United States from 14% in 1974 to less than 7% today. Malcolm Fraser will probably be able to do the same if he gets your support. Now, the most disastrous way in which the federal deficit or a state deficit or a local deficit can be financed is when the central banks, let's say the Federal Bank in Australia or the Federal Reserve Bank in the United States, instead of selling those government bonds, those government obligations to the public, buys those government bonds from the government. This is known as debt monetization. It's a $50 word. What it means is that these government bonds are entered in the money supply of the commercial banking system. Now, in the United States, and I'm going to make a simple case just for the sake of arithmetic, we have reserve requirements of about 20%, which is just about the same thing that you have here in Australia. Now, credit expansion is a reciprocal function of reserve requirements. So if reserve requirements are 20%, the reciprocal of 20% is 1, that's the numerator, over 20%, or 5, which means that every dollar, whether it is a dollar of debt or a dollar backed by goods actually produced, once it gets into the commercial banking system, generates at least $5 of credit. So this is the monetary inflation. So that what happens is that if the budget is balanced by the central bank buying the government obligations, for every dollar of deficit, you are generating ultimately at the end of the credit expansion, you generate 5 additional dollars of claims against goods and services. So the price goes up. Now, once a government begins to inflate, it is caught just as much as any other segment of society into a vicious cycle because, for instance, in 1974, the government, the wholesale price level increased by 20%. Now, the biggest purchaser of goods and services in the United States is the federal government. So this meant that if in 1975 the government was going to buy the same amount of goods and services that it bought in 1974, never mind increasing its purchases, it had to find at least 20% more money to stay at the same level. So it has to find that money for political reasons. It cannot increase taxation, so the debt gets financed by having the Federal Reserve System buy those government obligations and therefore increasing the inflationary spiral. So that is, in a very, very rough way, the mechanism of the inflationary spiral. Now, notice this. The Federal Reserve System and fractional reserve banking, that can be looked upon as an engine of inflation, but obviously somebody is the driver of that engine, is the driver of that vehicle. And in this particular case, who drives that inflationary vehicle? It is not elected officials, because they can merely respond to the pressures of their own constituents. You see their earning power reduced from year to year, so they want government to do something. Now, one of the drivers of this engine of inflation, unfortunately, has been the labor movement in the United States, which insists on higher minimum wages, which throw people out of work, and then insists on bigger pensions, all sorts of benefits that put more of a burden and that increase the deficit. Another driver of that engine of inflation could also be big business by wanting certain particular favors, certain particular exceptions, and so on, so that really everybody, all the major pressure groups, drive at one time or the other that engine of inflation. It cannot be corrected by changing the monetary system. You cannot change the monetary system and leave everything else the same. A better way would be to dismantle and take away from labor some of the monopolistic powers that it has acquired, and to take away from certain industries also the monopolistic powers that that those industries have acquired. In other words, a divorce of government both from the activities of labor unions and from the activities of corporations and big industries. I'm afraid I'm being too long-winded, but...
you preach non-government or against government interference, and the last comment there would seem that you would agree with the Taft-Hartley Acts and the Trade Practices.
I heard the Taft-Hartley Law about 15 years ago when I was in college, and I don't remember the details of the Taft-Hartley Law.
The principle.
Yeah. There are some features of the Taft-Hartley Law that are absolute anathema to labor unions, and this is the 80-day breathing period in which unions are forbidden to strike, and then government or some government-appointed official acts as the arbitrator and sort of cracks together the heads of the labor and management and say, okay, boys, get together, settle your differences. There are other features of the Taft-Hartley Law, however, that labor unions like. I don't know what those features are, but certainly if it were up to me, I would be very much in favor of the repeal of the Taft-Hartley Law. I'd be in favor of the repeal of the Wagner Act, the Norris LaGuardia Act, and the Landrum-Griffin Law. I would be also in repeal of the antitrust laws of the United States, because the alleged purpose of those antitrust laws in the United States was to preserve competition. The actual meaning of those antitrust laws was to maintain the status quo, to protect the biggest, most inefficient, flabbiest industry from the vicissitudes of competition. So, by a system of repealing those laws that have created labor monopolies, that have created industrial cartels and industrial monopolies, then who will ultimately benefit will be the consumer, the citizen, because somebody has to pay for all of those inefficient monopolies, and it's people like us.
You favor a laissez-faire type of society, economic society?
A laissez-faire in which the government plays a proper role. Look, I was a businessman. I was involved in mining. I had a small quarry in Utah. Look, there are bastards in every walk of life. There are some businessmen. We also have our own share of bastards. So it has to be a laissez-faire system of economics within the context of a government that protects the rights of every individual to his own life, to his own earnings, to his own property, provided that as each individual goes about his sphere of activity, doesn't infringe on the rights of other people. This is a simple guideline. I hope it doesn't sound simplistic. It is actually the most difficult type of government there is. It's the most sophisticated type of society that you can have, and it is not the system of yesterday. You look, for instance, at socialism. Now, hell, there is nothing new about socialism. That is merely the secularized 20th century version of feudalism. Because, well, if you take the Marxist ideology, not the original Marxist ideology, but the way it has been interpreted in Russia and in all sorts of other countries, the name of the game there is collectivism. What they want to do is always something for the good of the public, for the common good. Now, the common good is not an absolute primary. It is not an irreducible cause. It is the consequence of the sum total of the good of every individual in that particular society. So, if you have a system that protects the rights of each individual, Not that the government should do anything for the individual. Just leave him alone, give him freedom of action, freedom to produce, freedom to create, and as long as the individual doesn't infringe on the rights of other people, then you have the maximum amount of wealth production. And when it comes to wealth production, just like the feudalist kings and the feudalist nobility didn't have the faintest idea of how to create wealth. They only knew how to rip it off. The socialists of today haven't got the faintest idea of how to create wealth. They assume that it's just there. All you have to do is to grab it, seize it, and then redistribute it. And of course, in the process, a great deal of it sticks to your own fingers. So socialism and any variety of it, be it left-wing socialism, alias communism, or right-wing socialism, which is national socialism, or fascism, those are the systems of the past. And one of the reasons in which they have been able to establish their system is by telling you something about the inevitability of Marxism, the inevitability of the historical process, that this is the system that we have and we will have it in perpetuity, which philosophically is really a denial of a very, very real characteristic that each human being has, and that is free will, because you can change your mind about anything tomorrow or the day after if you have a certain amount of knowledge and so on. This doesn't mean that if you thought in a certain way today, you're not going to change your mind tomorrow. But the Marxists say that, well, somehow there is the dice, the biological dice is loaded against man. That you can only think in a certain way, that the historical struggle has always been the fight between the haves and the have-nots. And the ultimate result of it is that operating on that collectivist base of the common good, who the hell is the public out there? The public interest, how do you define it? There is no such concrete item out there that you can point your finger to and say, that's the public. So somebody, some self-anointed expert, must rise and say, I know what the public good is, this is how I define it, and this is how I'm going to ram it down everybody else's throat. So that collectivistic type of thinking necessarily has to lead to the erosion of the modern 20th century concept of democracy, to the erosion and destruction of representative republics, which are then replaced by banana republics, where anything goes provided you don't get caught at it, and also in the mushrooming of all sorts of totalitarian regimes, be they left-wing or right-wing, that we have seen in the century. The most recent example, of course, is India. They say that India went from democracy into fascism. But what is forgotten is that India went from feudalism directly into socialism without developing a base of wealth that could be distributed. So they went from feudalistic system to a socialist system. They went from the frying pan into the fire.
Thank you.
Question a little bit closer to home. Eugene, an industry in Kalgoorlie that obviously can't stand on 2 feet. It's a gold mining industry.
Right.
What is the role of government to support a ailing or a non-profit making industry?
Well, if this is what the Australian people want, if the Australian people want to help the gold industry survive for the next year or year and a half, or until the time when the new international monetary system is created again, that's fine. If they don't want to, nothing I say, nothing you say, nothing that Mayor Finlayson says him do any good. So the thing is to consider all of the facts that exist in this area of Ashela, put in its proper context. I don't think that 10 or 15 years ago this section of Western Australia had a base metal industry. Well, now you have a very, very thriving, by any standard, base metal industry. You have nickel. There is that Kilgourley nickel smelter. There is the nickel mine and concentrator in Kambalga. These have a good effect on the local economy. They provide jobs. There is the Windara nickel deposit. Oh, right, it's not immediately at the doorstep of Kilgourley, but that also brings indirect benefits to Kilgourley. There is also the fact that now the Fraser administration could very well be phasing out that idiotic 1973 foreign investment guideline, which insists on a 50% Australian equity for foreign investment. Now, that if that policy were to be played down, toned down, actually I'd like to see it removed, because there is a shortage of capital anywhere in the world, and I, as a foreign investor, even if I had all of the money needed to open up, let's say, to do exploration for copper, lead, and zinc in Western Australia, and then after I found a deposit, I would want to go ahead and develop it. Under the current guidelines, I must find an Australian counterpart, an Australian partner who will put up half of the money. Now, Australia has a very, very thin capital market. And I think that the Whitlam administration, when it launched the slogan Australia by foreign companies, it has to be a dollar brought into Australia because of two factors. One is credit expansion on the basis of fractional reserve banking. Your fractional reserve banking is 20%, let's say. Reciprocal 20% is 5, means that as a minimum, every dollar of foreign investment that gets into Australia will generate at least $5 of local wealth, which will be in the hands of Australians. Then if you include the industrial multiplier, then you will generate additional dollars in terms of ancillary industries that will go in, real estate operators, house builders, medical groups who will install a hospital and so on, equipment suppliers that will pop up all over the place. You really have an enormous impetus. So, translated in English, that Whitlam policy in effect told you, we are willing to forego the benefits of $5 of locally generated wealth in order for us to control 50 cents of every dollar that you bring in. But the thing is, even if that foreign investment policy guideline had not been put into effect, the fact is that a foreign company who comes into Australia has to abide by Australian law and has to pay Australian taxes, just like anybody else. So that ultimately the government will get anyway that half or 42% or whatever it is or whatever profits the foreign company makes in Australia. So what that foreign investment policy actually did was to dry up the flow of capital in Australia. Now, in order for anybody to succeed, you don't have to be the best in the absolute sense. All you have to do is to be a little better than the nations that are competing against you for foreign investment capital. So, if the Fraser government tones down this particular Whitlam policy, tones it down to the point where the attraction for foreign capital in Australia is going to be greater than the attraction for foreign capital in Canada, in Mexico, in Latin America, then even though there is a liquidity shortage, capital is a very timid commodity. It only goes into those countries where it can be certain that whatever it creates will not nationalize or expropriate it, and when it comes to that, Australia is a very, very good country. But it also needs the attraction that it doesn't have to go through this artificial charade of finding an Australian partner and finding an Australian equity. So, the combination of a lot of things, the fact that you are now developing a good metal-based industry, Nicholas one, and pretty soon you're going to have copper, lead and zinc. The fact that what's looming on the horizon is the setup of a gold exchange standard, at least at the international level, which can only exist if the official price of gold is pushed upwards, somewhere, I would think, I might be wrong, between $150 and $200 an ounce. The fact that the Fraser administration, and I think this is reflected by an interview that Minister Menzaras, Minister of Minerals of Energy here in Western Australia. This was about 2 weeks before he came to Australia. I read an article in which he was soft-pedaling this business of the 50% Australian equity requirement. So the Fraser administration is moving in that direction, and these are all very good indications. So if you can support Fraser, or, if you will, if you can put in a little more pressure on the Fraser administration to get rid and tone down, or tone down, this foreign investment policy. And also if Fraser could be successful in cutting down the federal bureaucracy and on federal spending. You see, even if everything else doesn't change, that the Fraser administration is able to cut in half the inflationary spiral, then this will be marvelous, marvelous news for an export, for a raw material exporting country such as Australia, because it is your own inflation that is making your own goods non-competitive. Now, if Jerry Ford, who I'm told is a man who is incapable of chewing gum and walking at the same time, can cut in half the inflationary rate, can do it, I'm sure that Malcolm Fraser will be able to improve on that performance and perhaps eliminate inflation altogether, and that's something devoutly to be wished.
Mr. Gutiardi, could I be afforded the luxury of a second question? Am I right in detecting in your answer to Wally, or Younger, some inconsistency? In your earlier dissertation, you mentioned simplistically, and I say this with all due respect, simplistically reduce the legitimate role of government to four concepts, two of them relating to the law, the criminal and the civil field, and the other two what we might call the enforcement of law and order, one on domestically on the side of the police and the other nationally on the side of a military, naval and defence force.
Yes.
In answer to the question, however, you said, at least I believe you said, it would be legitimate for the national government of Australia, having regard to the predictions that you've made relating to the future of gold and the monetary system, to maintain the present tax exemptions on gold until such time as gold is able to stand on its own 2 feet.
No.
Now, I detect some inconsistency here. The question is, am I right? If I'm wrong, would you please explain why?
No, I haven't said anything regarding this elimination of the tax incentive. Let's see, how's a good way of phrasing it? This is subsidy, if you will, if you want to call it subsidy.
Subsidy?
It is not a subsidy.
The federal government aren't paying out 1 cent.
Mm-hmm.
Not a cent.
Right, okay.
And if I
so it is not,
impose,
it is not a subsidy.
Impose it's these, this new law in the foreseeable future, it's not going to get a cent.
Right.
Because none of these mines are offloaded at a profit anyway.
Right.
No, that's the point.
No. When it comes to a law, whether that law is good, bad or indifferent, it has to be universal. you can't have exceptions for one industry or another industry. In fact, I think it was, is Stanley here from ABC?
Yeah.
Where are you? Yeah, Stan, when you said, should the government give a subsidy to the local gold industry, what was my answer?
You said no.
No, okay. So I'm consistent in that. I don't want subsidies, and I don't want a particular industry. I would, and this is just based on philosophical principle. Whether a law is good or bad, no one should be exempted from it, and this is based on the American principle that every man is created equal under the law, meaning that under the law there are no special privileges for anybody, whether one's name happens to be Richard Nixon or Henry Ford. What can be done on the part of gold producers is to hang on tooth and nail to maintain the mines not in operation, but to do the kind of maintenance work that will keep prevent the structure from collapsing, to do the minimum maintenance, and try to keep those mines in fairly good shape until the new international monetary system is created. Because once that's created, that will be the biggest shot in the arm that government could give them. And I agree with you when you say that, well, the repeal of this tax holiday to gold miners really won't affect them because none of them are making any profit anyway. Now, even before the new international monetary system is created, you will see an upsurge in the price of gold because now many, many more people are infinitely wiser in regard to monetary policy than they were 10, 15, or 20 years ago, if nothing else, because they have seen the loss in the purchasing power of their currency. So you will see more and more pressure on Canberra, on Washington, London, and so on, for an anti-inflationary policy. And I hope and pray that when labor unions will ultimately discover that the consequence of inflation, which they do so much to aid and abet because they are one of the principal causal factor in creating an inflationary spiral, once the labor unions realize that the ultimate consequence of inflation is unemployment, and this is perhaps the job for all of you, you have to talk to your labor leaders and say, okay, fine, you're going to have more money tomorrow, next year, next week, in the next 6 months. But how many of your people will be able to maintain their job under current conditions? So if you're able to translate for labor leaders the facts of life, the realities of economics, and point out that if they persist on this kind of policy that they're insisting in, not that they should stop, not that they should mitigate their demands for higher wages, better conditions, and so on, but that they should not get involved in the political process. If you're able to do that, and if the unions are sold on the idea that inflation leads to unemployment, then you will bring to a halt this inflationary syndrome.
Could I ask one further question?
Sure.
I say with all due respect, you know, in theory, what you say is not very far away from my own philosophy.
That's the tragedy. We all think
there was the same. In actual down-to-earth terms, getting back to the gold mining industry, this community here is still largely dependent upon the ready cash flow from gold. I don't think this town could exist if the gold mining industry was just to go on a care and maintenance basis right across the board. You know, the only existing operating mine within the environs of Kalgoorlie was to close. But Kalgoorlie could survive as a really viable community. I think the need for some government assistance is vital. We can't wait. If it was 12 months, perhaps, yes. But the Kathleen Vaughan, it may be now, it may be never situation, Kalgoorlie couldn't really survive. People wouldn't have that situation. It's not
part of human nature. Mm-hmm. People are going to pack up and go.
Mm-hmm.
And I dread that thought, but I think we have to, you know, live with it. This is a possibility, it's a probability, that many people won't be able to wait. And I see a legitimate role for government. And that's what I say, I'd like to expand your four simplistic roles of government, if you see them, in a decentralisation, if we might use the term. It should have some policy which it can apply in special and extreme circumstances, even if you concede that point.
Well,
I see another role for government.
Couldn't then a government, for instance, act not as a saviour, but couldn't either the Western Australia government, the state government, or
but
Canberra,
the national government,
yes. Right. Couldn't government make loans at competitive interest rates to the local gold industry so that they can have the operating cash for maintaining the current gold mines in fairly good shape without adversely affecting the employment picture, and then have a clause in this contractual agreement to the effect that once the price of gold goes up, or the new international monetary system is created whereby the official price of gold will be pegged upwards, that this money will be repaid to the Australian taxpayers.
I'd agree, Mr. Kenny. I'd agree very much with that. But just one final point. Getting back to the present threatened removal of the tax holiday. In fact, it's not a tax holiday at the present time because the companies aren't paying tax.
Right. They're not making money.
The change of law, apart from the emotive effect of the change of law, there's not going to be an extra cent flow out of the pocket of the gold producer, nor an extra cent into the treasury of the federal government. Now, I would agree with you that this is meddlesome on the part of the national government. They're not going to get an extra cent out of it. You know, why bring about this situation at this time? Because the moment the law changes, into that financial year, if circumstances haven't dramatically changed, there's not going to be a cent flowing from that change of law into the federal government. Therefore, bringing down this decision now is quite meddlesome and quite mischievous and quite useless.
I agree with you. But there is a long-term psychological effect. I suspect that policy came in at this time primarily for two reasons. One is a local reason, and one is an international, fits into the international puzzle. The local reason, as I understand it, is that there is one of the largest American mining companies, Newmont, who is going to open up a gold mine in
Tulsa.
And Tennant Creek also. Okay, so that once a company of that size, with its capital resources, starts mining gold in Australia, and in effect is exempt from Australian taxation, then politics being what it is, there is going to be a great deal of justifiable hue and cry, or envy, if you will, about the Australian government giving preferential treatment to a large American company. That would be a local
reason. It would only be preferential if the company was in the immediate future to pay tax.
Mm-hmm.
The situation as it is now, they still won't be, if they get off the ground, they still won't be paying tax for considerable time.
Right. Would have been.
And the other part that fits in the international puzzle is this, that the psychological effect will be to discourage more and more private individuals from buying gold so as to achieve the effect of their selling gold in the free market, further depress the price, and therefore make it easier for the central bankers to seize that gold. And for the first time in the century, we are seeing, incidentally, the policy of the Western nations, the monetary policy of Western nations, meet with the, at least the purchases the purchasing policy of Soviet Russia. Soviet Russia has had a very, very bad harvest. It has to buy grain from Canada and from the United States. It has no appreciable foreign exchange to buy that with. So it has to sell gold in the open market. Those sales of Russian gold further depress the price of gold, which is something that everybody at the national level wants. They want to get their hands on the stuff. I'm sorry.
Mr. Gutierrez, one aspect that the federal government is doing at the moment, I'm concerned about, and that, as you said before, tariffs and quotas and subsidies are inflationary. Well, this is last week, the Ford Motor Company in Australia, which is 100% American owned, is investing $78 million in more plant and equipment and more jobs for people. And this, as you're probably aware of, I don't know, but the motor vehicle industry, building industry, is very heavily subsidising tariffs and quotas, uh-huh. Even more inequitous than tariffs. And they're sort of not looking at it. You've got the sort of values wrong, I feel, that they should be having more of the industries which are productive. Industry which relies on 50% tariffs is not very viable, I think. It's a great cost to the community. And there's industries, perhaps the gold industry, the iron ore industry, the nickel industry, which are sort of inflationary aspects, are coming through from the cost of the motor vehicles. That's coming through the wages. The unions require more wages because of the vehicles costing twice as much as they can produce, say, in Japan or overseas.
Mm-hmm.
What's the answer to this? How do we sort of encourage governments, not just this government, other governments, to sort of allocate resources properly? Because it seems to be completely wrong at the moment. They have this, I say, an aim to sort of allocate resources and properly. But to me, a company like Ford Motor Company investing $78 million in an unprofitable industry to Australia, I think you would agree with me, that $78 million invested in Australia, it might multiply five times. It also increase the pressure on more tariffs and subsidies as it becomes more inefficient as the time goes on. So this is a case, I think, where your theory about foreign investment is wrong.
In that particular case, yes, it is wrong. And this is because of the distortions introduced by all of these protective measures for the local industries. Protect the local industries against what? Against competition? But that's the name of the game. It would be far better to remove those protective tariffs. I bought the Ford Maverick 2 years ago in the United States. I paid $3,500. Had I wanted to buy a similar car in Australia, I would have had to pay almost $6,000. Almost double. The reason for that is the protection. I have to pay protection. Of course, Ford Motor Company of Australia does not pay that tariff. It's the ultimate Australian consumer who has to pay for that. Now, why is it that Australian auto producers, automobile producers, be called Ford or Chevy or Ford of USA or some other local enterprise, why do they resent the fact that free enterprise is a profit and loss system? This is what a lot of industries forget, that free enterprise is a profit and loss. You take your lumps just like you take your profits. And if things go badly, you can always rechannel your assets and your capital into more profitable local industries. This is what the International Division of Labor is all about. Australian capital should go into those Australian industries that can produce goods and services more competitively than in other nations. Some countries, for instance, India, wanted to industrialize very quickly, and they went ahead and they built all sorts of steel mills and iron pelletizing plants at enormous cost to their foreign exchange, when instead they should have logically developed their economy by boosting their agricultural products, cotton, whatever other Staples. You are quite correct in that analysis.
Have we tried it?
Well, by telling the Fraser government to remove those protected tariffs. But this is not the local problem. That's a national problem. This is something for Canberra.
It still affects the local miner here, the gold miner, who have to pay high wages to. They have to pay $5,000 for a $2,500 car. So you've got to give more wages. So it adds to everyone's costs.
Well,
you can see it locally. You know, it's an inflationary, very inflationary aspect of the economy. It's one aspect of it.
Once you remove those protective tariffs. Yeah. That will reflect itself in the price of the car. The lower is the price of the car, the greater will be the sales. And today, in any large industry, your marginal profit doesn't come from a high price. It comes from the volume of sales. Right? This is something that Henry Ford Sr. knew. He was the one that, quote-unquote, put America on wheels. And he put America on wheels, incidentally, by paying the highest wages. No one had ever heard before the fact that American workers could be paid $5 a day. That was an unheard-of figure. Well, Henry Ford, by mechanizing, by putting everything on, the ultimate division of labor, this is something that Adam Smith was talking about, was able to achieve the economy of scale. He was able to mass produce the Model T. It came out at a very, very low price. The fact that it was at low price, this didn't mean that he wasn't making profit. He made far more money than he ever did before when the price of cars were higher. Well, of course, there was no tariff at the time. Henry Ford never asked the U.S. government for protection against the Rolls Royce of England or Mercedes-Benz of Germany. He wasn't concerned with that.
I think close to hand the mode like to is, do you see the time if we exhaust our present gold stock within Australia, unless we are successful in our approach to the federal government through our federal member of Kalgoorlie, if our gold stocks are exhausted, do you see the time, unless we can, to think about the poor assistance to the industry, certainly to restore the tax incentive, when we would be buying gold from some other country overseas? Because the same thing, I see the same thing affecting America, unless it can be holding stock until that part of the new monetary system, the international monetary system, comes into effect, then you may be in the same boat as Australia in being forced to buy gold from some other country, and possibly at a higher price than that which would be required, we will say, for a subsidy to assist our mind until such time that that international monetary system comes into effect.
Well, the new international monetary system will be based on the US dollar. There is no way out of it. It will be only the dollar that will be convertible into gold. Every other currency will be convertible into US dollars and into one another currency at fixed exchange rates. So, from the point of view of the 20th century version of the gold standard, which is the gold exchange standard, it doesn't make one iota of difference whether Australia has 1 gram of gold in its reserves or a zillion tons of the stuff. Sure, it would be better if Australia did have some gold, because if some madman achieves power in Canberra and he goes on an atrocious spending spree and the Australian dollar gets down to zero, well, whoever happens to be the successor can always reissue a new currency based on Australia's gold reserves. In other words, unilaterally establish a fully gold-backed currency. Now, this is what I would like to see. The gold exchange standard has failed time and time again, because ultimately, the country that has the support currency cannot resist the temptation of inflating that particular currency so that it can obtain Arab ore, Australian iron ore, Rhodesian or Russian chrome by handing pieces of paper to all of those countries. It's a marvelous rip-off scheme when the country that has the support currency inflates itself. Now, you don't have that problem on the classical gold standard system, where the money in circulation is either gold coins and or gold-backed certificates at 100% convertibility. But I'm also a realist, and I realize that certainly big industries, big labor, don't want a gold standard that imposes limits on credit expansion. You see, under a gold standard, under a truly gold standard, a fully convertible currency, credit expansion, how quickly the money supply increases, how quickly the economy grows, that is predicated only by the aggregate decision of all 14 million Australians. In other words, you will have an increase in the monetary base only on the needs for capital of the Australian economy as reflected in the price mechanism. In other words, you will not have spectacular booms, but on the other hand, you wouldn't have spectacular depressions either. You would have real growth. You would have real growth at a rate of about 3 to 4% a year, which is what we saw consistently decade after decade after decade from the end of the Civil War in the United States. And you know, in the Civil War, President Lincoln, in effect, debauched the currency, and it created enormous problems for the American economy. And then in 1869, from 1869 until 1875, when they got rid of those bills, the greenbacks, so-called, and they established a fully convertible gold standard, within 6 months, all of those problems disappeared. And from the end of the Civil War until 1907, when you had the rich man's panic in the United States, which had nothing to do with the currency, you had an annual 3 or 4% increase in real wealth. And those were the times when the United States had unrestricted immigration. This was the time when millions upon millions of people came to the United States, found jobs. They didn't have to depend on welfare, when all of the industries, there were protective tariffs at the time, protective tariffs in the sense that the government raised its funds from applying duties on various commodities that were either imported or exported. But the fact was that throughout the 19th century, except for the period of the Civil War, government expenditures seldom exceeded 3% of the gross national income. Today, government expenditures, federal expenditures alone, I'm not talking about state expenditures or municipal expenditures, today, those combined expenditures come up to 44% of the gross national income. And if you add to that the 8% that is stolen from our pockets through inflation, you come to the conclusion that American citizens are paying at least 51 cents out of every dollar they earn. And in spite of that, the fact is that government has not cured the unemployment problem. Unemployment is worse today than it has ever been. That we are eating into our own wealth. In other words, we're not creating wealth. We're merely creating additional claims. against everybody's goods and services, not only Americans, but French, German, and so on. So, ultimately, you see, at least in the United States, even if we were to reform our own monetary system and have a more equitable tax system, if the hands of producers are still tied, the best monetary system in the world and the most equitable tax system in the world wouldn't do us any good. The important thing is that people who produce should have their hands free. Now, Australian producers do not have the kind of controls, limitations, and arbitrary man-made obstacles that American producers have. So in that respect, you're better off than we are.
Yes, but 2 points. One, we would surely be better off with a fully convertible gold standard. One. And two,
I agree with that.
That's a fact.
Yes.
All right. Now, but your last statement is not consistent with what you have said previously, and which I have read previously, you're right. That at an international, at a present international monetary settlement, it's not a case of who owes what paper to who, but when they go back and consider, it is who owes
gold
to whom.
Yes.
And so therefore, it's far better for us to retain our mines in production for the time when the new system comes in, so that we can get back to the idealistic system. The ideal, and it is something that cannot be achieved, it can be achieved, and that is a fully convertible
gold
standard, because it's the one control that we have over government, and that's the point that you made originally.
Mr. Thulesen, I could kiss you right now. This is precisely what I would like to see. But what we would like to see is not necessarily what we are going to get. We can argue until we are blue in the face, extolling the virtues of a fully convertible currency into a specie, be it gold or petroleum or uranium or whatever it is. It just happens to be gold because that has been the combined decision of millions upon millions of people across 5,000 years of monetary history. Okay, so there is no getting away from that. So, even though you and I and lots of other people would be in favor of a fully convertible currency, 100% backed by gold, the fact is that if Australia could succeed in doing that, it would give a marvelous example to the entire world. And then, you see, this question of the price of gold would become totally material. Because once the unit of currency is a unit weight of gold, a gram of gold is a gram of gold, regardless it is in Australia, or in the United States, or in England, or whatever. All of these denominations of the various currencies, and francs, and dollars, and pounds, and so on, those are artificial things to hide the fact that real money is gold. Everything else is a money substitute. Now, perhaps the way to get to what we want, which is a fully convertible currency, will have to be first a gold exchange standard, the one based on a superb currency tied to gold and every other currency tied to the dollar. That will bring us closer to that ultimate thing, but we don't necessarily have to wait for that. If you are able to put your idea across first to people in Kalgoorlie, then to people in Western Australia, and then to the rest of other Australians and say, look, neither you or I or any or your fathers or your grandfathers ever had anything to say about monetary policy. Why don't we take our future, our destiny, into our own hands? Why don't we say we have got to have an honest currency so that we'll force Canberra to live only within the income that it is able to raise through taxation? Then you have frozen your government into honesty. You have forced your government to behave honestly towards its own citizens. It is impossible under a gold standard to inflate the currency. And this is why many governments hate or claim to hate gold, because gold is a chemical element. You cannot fake it, you cannot counterfeit it. A real currency would be a unit weight of a particular commodity which is scarce, has value, and has a store of value. That's an enormous problem, because he would run immediately against the ideology of labor leaders, not the rank-and-file members. The rank-and-file members, chances are that after about a five-minute conversation, they will agree with you and me. You would run against the concerted opposition of big industries and big labor. You know, in America, Mark Twain said, live within your means, even if you must borrow to do so. Well, all of us, not only in the United States, but in Australia and every other country, we have borrowed to the point that no way these national debts can ever be repaid. They will ultimately be repaid, since debts are denominated in units of currency. When the worth of the currency goes down to zero, your debts go down to zero. This is precisely the explicit policy that the Weimar Republic introduced in Germany. They didn't want to pay those reparations for the Allies. So they said, okay, since our debts with France and England and the United States and Russia are denominated in Deutsche Marks, if we can bring down to zero the value of the Deutsche Mark, we have wiped out our debts. By the same token, some governments, by deliberately debauching their currency, this is how they wipe out the national debt. The third largest item in the budget, in the federal budget of the United States, is the interest on the debt. The biggest expenditure in the budget is the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, which incidentally, that particular department will be in business as long as it succeeds in keeping enough Americans sick, dumb, and poor. Because when enough Americans become healthy, wealthy, and wise, then there will be no longer any need for the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. So that's the biggest expenditure. The second biggest expenditure is for national defense. The third biggest expenditure is the interest on the debt. Not even the